Okay, so go ahead and get started. Happy Wednesday. I think I owe you some stuff. Were you able to find the papers on Blackboard, ma'am? Sorry about that. So now I'm hooked there. It's in the right place. Hopefully you'll find the readings this week sort of fun. They're a little bit out there. I still need to extract comments and rankings for last week's rewriting, which I hope to do later today, and need to give you extract your essays that you turned in and give them to you soon. There's a bit of a process there, so I'm going to try to find time to do that. Any questions, comments about the class? Any issues on that?
Yeah. I was one of the people who couldn't use the music before today. So I went on Blackboard last night and they went there under course materials. It was only the mathematics one that was breaking.
Right, so my latest email today will tell you that it should be under course materials now.
But what about the recitation? Because I was fine with that, wasn't it?
Oh, no, the recitation is on the class website, which is not Blackboard.
No, I mean, but those readings, I mean, it's a recitation, right? Or is it a different topic?
No, recitation is a different thing. If you go to the class website, you'll see it down at the bottom, recitations. And so that's a different thing that I make up. Yeah. Okay, so last time we started talking about waves, and it turns out understanding the basic characteristics of waves is fairly critical to understand light, quantum mechanics, and by virtue of quantum mechanics, almost everything else we're going to talk about the rest of the semester. There's a lot of very strange modern physics that comes out of the kinds of things that come out of quantum mechanics. So in a sense, that's turns out to be because waves are so important. So at least much of this beginning of class this time around is going to be really talking about waves of different sorts. And fundamentally, there's a piece to waves which is fairly simple. You can sort of imagine if you just have something hanging from a spring and you just pull it down and let it go, it's just going to do this. It's going to oscillate up and down with a fixed amplitude. Eventually it'll slow down, but basically it'll just go up and down with a fixed amplitude. And we call that simple harmonic motion. And it can be studied analytically, but it's really a fairly simple thing. So you can imagine in some stadium full of people, you know, you're at the Olympics or something, and people are very excited about what's going on, so they stand up. And you can imagine people in their seats sort of going, yay, like this, right? And they could even imagine them doing some harmonic motion. There's this thing that I'm sure you've all seen, maybe even done, where you do this wave in the stadium, right? Where the people in one section will all stand up and do this, and then they'll sit down, and as they sit down, the people next to them stand up. And as they sit down, the people next to them stand up, etc. And if you think about what that is, all the particles in the stadium, all the people, are doing nothing but executing a simple up and down motion. They're not going anywhere. So the thing that makes lots of particles doing simple harmonic motion get transformed into a wave has to do with the coherence, a connection between particles in one place to particles in other places. So in the stadium, that connection is visual and timing, basically. We stand up, and the people next to me know as I go down, they go up, and that's what makes this wave go. Okay, it's sort of a person-to-person connection. If I want to make a wave on a string or a rope, like that, how it works is when I pull up, This pulls pieces of the rope here up, which pulls pieces of the rope here up. And then when I go down, it starts pulling them down. But it takes time for that to move. So this whole shape moves with some speed along the rope. F equals ma. What's happening is as this piece of rope goes down, it exerts a force here. If there's a lot of mass in this rope, it takes it a little moment to accelerate because F equals ma. You only have a certain acceleration. If there's a lot of mass there, it's hard to move. So this begins to come down. As this goes down, it exerts a force here, which exerts a force here. When I'm going up, I'm exerting a force up. So you can sort of imagine this shape propagates along this, we call it a medium, by F equals ma. And you can then watch the shape move. Okay, I can make sort of arbitrary shapes. But note that all of the parts, if you look at the black pieces of tape along the rope, they don't go anywhere except basically up and down. Okay, so the way a wave works is some sort of motion where there's connectivity to other pieces through different mechanisms. And you can have waves on strings like this. You can have waves via the motion of molecules in air. You can have waves on water. And they're all sort of dictated by the same kind of thing. So we characterize waves by sort of their amplitude, if you will. Well, we define it as amplitude. So if you can imagine a string or a level of water and a wave is propagating on it, you'll have displacements which are transverse to the direction of motion here, which have a displacement length, which is effectively its amplitude. So these water molecules are going to be up here, and then they're going to oscillate down to here, and then they're going to come back up. Sort of like if I tie something on the string or the tape on this rope, it moves in that kind of motion, straight up and down, as the shape of the wave travels. The motion of the particle is moving transverse to the direction of the motion of the wave in this case. Waves that do that are called transverse waves. Okay? You can have waves in media where the wave shape is traveling this way and the particles are actually moving along the direction of the motion. And that would be known as a longitudinal wave because you're going longitudinally along the direction of motion. So I have the classic example for that. Be kind enough to hold that. It's basically a slinky, okay? You can see the wave traveling along the slinky, and what's happening is if I put a piece of tape here or something, you can see it move like this. Okay? So it turns out that sound waves are vibrations of molecules in the air transverse to the direction of motion of the wave itself. So you can have longitudinal waves, you can have transverse waves. For longitudinal waves, the amplitude is, again, how much it moves before it turns around and goes back the other way. Or the total distance it goes back and forth would be 2 times the amplitude. The amplitude itself, it mathematically, when you try to understand, when we describe intensity of a wave, which is basically a measure of how much energy is traveling along the wave. Waves are important in part, not just because they can sort of move something or you see them move. The medium itself isn't moving where the wave is going, but energy is actually moving. And you see this, say, with water waves at the beach. What we mean, physicists, I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about it. Physicists have managed to take the concept of energy, which I think is a very exciting English word when we talk about energy, and we managed to just dilute it into almost as boring as it can be. We define energy as the ability to do work. And we define work as basically doing, exerting a force through a distance. So if I say all that, I think the whole idea of what energy is just manages to get lost. It turns out that these meanings are very useful when you're formally needing to use them, but I don't. And we may talk a lot more about it as we go if we need to, but I'm going to try to more or less avoid that. But this is one instance where I am. We know that energy is flowing in something if, for example, it can move something when it hits it. It can exert a force on it. So, for example, water waves can certainly do that. Right? So even though the particles in the wave are more or less going up and down, they can move stuff around. So there's energy that's flowing in the waves. This turns out to be pretty important. When molecules in the air vibrate back and forth as a sound wave goes, what you're doing is you actually have regions of the air where you have higher pressure than other regions. You have more molecules per inch, per cubic centimeter here than you do here. And it's really pressure waves that are traveling. Those waves are the things that hit your eardrums and they push your eardrum in. That's what activates the basic sensors or whatever that you interpret as sound, okay? If the amplitude of that pushing is greater because you're closer to the speaker, it's pushing harder on your ears and you hear it as a much more intense sound. And quite literally, there's much more energy involved in the air pressure pushes much more force on your eardrums and moves it much more. And so there's real energy involved. This turns out to be incredibly important, the waves actually can carry energy, even though those air molecules aren't really moving. They're just going back and forth. So they're sort of strange that way. Waves can move at different speeds. Guess I have an example of something that involves waves here. What I have is a series of metal bars. Some are long here. These are all the same length. These are shorter. Okay? They're all connected by a stiff wire that basically runs through each of them. This wire is stiff enough that if I twist the wire here, it twists it a little bit to the stuff beside. So all I'm doing is moving one of these, and note that it moves a lot of these. Okay, so the stiff wire is now the thing that is providing the connectivity between the masses that are actually doing the wave. All right. So there are a few things we can look at with this. One is that the velocity of the wave depends on the medium. Because F equals ma, as I mentioned, if something is exerting a force on a particle next to it, if that particle has a lot of mass, it takes it a moment to get moving. So the wave shape itself will propagate more slowly. If we were to have a pond made out of putty instead of a pond made out of water, and we threw a big boulder in it, we would see the waves move much slower in the honey than they would in the water, because basically the honey, it's harder to move the particles in the honey, so it's as if they have more mass. Here what we're going to see is that the wave will travel a certain speed where these particles are heavy, because the bars are long, and then the wave is going to hit this region where the particles are lighter. Okay? So, tell me what to see. Can you see it? Okay. So what did you observe? What do you think? Yeah?
Looks like the waves are feeling that they're smaller and more intense than the other.
This is, it's hard to say. This one may look like, I mean, the bars are longer, I don't know, but look at the speed, okay? This one has a speed that's slower than this one. Maybe it's easier to see that way. Okay. Got a fast one, and then it's sort of slow. Right. So waves care about the medium here. Yeah.
Is that refraction that you're observing?
No. That is not, but we will talk about refraction, diffraction, reflection, all that stuff in there as we go. So one of the things I mentioned to you, I think last class, and what we were looking at there is I was creating a wave just by like that. Sort of a, okay. And one of the things I mentioned to you is that mathematically it turns out that might be really hard to describe. It turns out that we don't actually need to describe single pulses so much. We just really need to understand harmonic waves. Harmonic waves are things that repeat in space and time. So the reason that we can do that can you see that? Let me turn the lights out a little bit. I can make it bigger. Alright, so here is a waveform on a string, for example, that's of a very strange shape. It turns out that we can mathematically describe this waveform as a sum of different harmonic waves with different amplitudes. For example, if you add up all of these, you'll end up with this other strange form. So you can sort of see it as they bring them out here. This really is a description of all of these different amplitude and different frequency, that is the oscillation going up and down, waves. And the area of physics that does that is called Fourier analysis. And I basically can make this look as much like a square as I would like by just adding more and more different waves and different frequencies. So as it turns out, we don't need to actually know how to describe waves mathematically, looking at their inharmonic characters, but we can just look at the harmonic pieces. So this is really all we have to understand, is sort of what do we mean when we look at a wave like this. So what's happening is this piece and its continuation, both directions, is just moving in the medium, whatever it is. This would be a transverse wave. And if we have something where the harmonic motion is along direction of the wave propagation, then it would be called a longitudinal wave. And the classic example for this is sound. And the classic example, say for a transverse wave over here, would be something like waves on a string or waves in water. So if we look at this wave, spatially, if I were to freeze time, then spatially what we get is a repetition of the shape over a characteristic distance. And that's what we call a waveform. Okay? And if we put a cork on this, or a piece of string, and we ask how long does it take to go up and down as this shape moves through, it goes through one cycle of its motion in a time which is equal to one period. So if we think about how the wave itself moves, the wave shape moves one wavelength in one period of time. So that means the speed of the wave, or the velocity of the wave, is equal to lambda divided by the period. And this is typically in meters per second. So you can see how important this sort of 1 over period is. It's sort of a characteristic that we often use for waves. We define 1 over the period as the frequency. And we give it a symbol of F for sound. And we give it a symbol nu, that's a Greek letter nu, for if we're dealing with light waves. So we'll usually use nu, just so you know. It has units of 1 over seconds. And one of the things that is very important to do in science, and it is certainly important to do in physics, is in some ways all about job security, and the way you can secure your job is to take things that are simple and rename them. Okay? So it's very important to do that. So instead of talking about frequency in terms of 1 over seconds, which people sort of understand, we take this and we rename this entire unit as 1 hertz, named after some physics guy named Hertz. Okay? And we give it a symbol, 1HZ. All right, so if you ever look at your radio dials and you see KHZ or MHZ, that stands for kilohertz or megahertz, and it's just telling you the frequency. It's telling you how many oscillations per second the radio waves that are hitting your radio are oscillating. How much they're oscillating. So what this says is that if we have one crest of the wave per second past a given point, then it would be 1 hertz. If 10 waves per second pass, it'd be 10 hertz. Okay? If we have 1,000 crests per second pass, then we would have 1,000 hertz, or what we call 1 kilohertz. And similarly, if we have 1,000,000, then we have 1,000,000 hertz, or 1 megahertz. Okay, so sorry for all the lingo, but you'll hear all these terms, so I want them to make some sense. So this actually turns out to be a very important formula, this formula for the velocity. I usually remember it like this. Frequency is in 1 over seconds, so this would be a distance divided by seconds, so that's meters per second, so that's the velocity. So this sort of relates the basic the way it oscillates with the velocity of the wave itself and its fundamental wavelength. So this is something we'll run into some. If that were all there were to waves, waves would be sort of boring. It turns out that if something is a wave, it exhibits very particular characteristics. And this is true for all waves. So if a wave, it exhibits a number of things. One is it exhibits interference. And interference basically tells you that if you have multiple waves, the wave amplitudes add together. So this, you know, if you're in a wave pool and you have a big wave coming this way and a big wave coming this way and you have both waves hit you at the same time, you get lifted way up. If you have a big wave coming this way and you have a big trough coming here, the whole thing goes through and you don't really even notice it. Okay? So for waves, it turns out that whatever their amplitude happens to be, it adds together with whatever other waves happen to be there. We call it superposition. And superposition can actually be pretty cool. So let's say that I have a wave shape here that looks like this, and another one that looks like this, and they go toward each other. Look what happens. Okay, do you see how that goes? Oh. Why are we going backwards? Let me have one wave up and one wave down and have them run into each other. They sort of cancel out. You see how that works? So they add together. So this leads to lots of fun stuff. So here's an example of it. We have two wave pulses coming. They add together, and they just basically go through each other. I mean, they're like separate entities in some sense, but they add together very nicely. So this is an example of interference. Often, if they add together like this so that their amplitudes are basically going the same way and what you get is something that's that much bigger, then it's often called constructive interference. If this one had an amplitude that was down and they add together and basically cancel out, we call that destructive interference. This leads to some sort of fun stuff, actually. If I have two waves that are, we say that if I have one wave, okay, it has a certain time. For example, if it's on water, as I start to hit the water, that dictates the timing of the wave as it goes through. Okay? I can change the frequency with which, and then I'll get lots of little, or I do this slowly, and I'll get just a big wave. The speed of the wave is fixed, but I could imagine having two sources of waves. If I do them at the same frequency and the same timing, then they will produce waves that look exactly the same. And we call those coherent waves. I could also imagine starting waves where they just have different timing. So those would be not coherent, okay? I could have different frequency waves, all right? And so since waves add together and they don't care what the amplitudes are, what the timing is, what the frequencies are, they're just going to add together. It turns out that waves adding together make for all sorts of really sort of interesting things that can happen. Okay? So it turns out that sound is a wave. So all of these weird phenomena happen when you deal with sound waves. They add together, and sometimes they can cancel out, and sometimes they add together and get loud. If I were to take a graphical representation of a sound wave, say like this, so there's a sound wave, you can hear it, but I can probably go one better on that. That happens, what's happening is the molecules are moving at a certain frequency, a certain back and forth speed. That particular frequency is what you hear as the pitch that you hear from the sound, okay? The degree to which it moves back and forth is what you hear as the loudness. So imagine that I graphically put the displacement of air molecules as a function of time sort of here. Then you can imagine I actually have a little sine curve here or something. Here. So if I put the speakers working, okay, so that's a pitch of one of these. Now what I have are two devices, these are tuning forks, so when I hit this mechanically it vibrates back and forth. That knocks air molecules, and that's what gets the sound propagating out towards. Here's one that's basically identical. Oops. Not good. Okay, so they're close to the same frequency. So that means each of them are producing waves that might look like so. There's a certain amplitude and they have a certain frequency. Now what I want to do is I'm going to change the frequency of one of these by putting a mask on one of these prongs. And that's going to slow its prong down a little bit, which is going to change the sound. Now knocking those molecules less often. Frequency is now less. If I don't have that mass on it, higher pitch, lower pitch. Okay? Now, I'm not going to drag you through the mathematics, but you can take a sine curve of one frequency and you can add it to a sine curve with a slightly different frequency. Which is what we're doing here. We have two waves, one slightly offset in frequency from the other. And when you do this, it turns out if you superimpose these things, you get this sort of weird shape. All right? And what this shape tells you is that you get a big amplitude that goes to zero and then gives you a big amplitude that goes to zero. And this change will happen with a frequency that will depend on the difference of these two frequencies. So to bring that back, I'm going to hit both of these at the same time. You hear the little fluctuation? That's actually the changing amplitude. I can make it happen so that we can hear it better if I make the frequencies a little more close to one another. closer, you'll hear that. We call it beat frequency. You'll hear it, but it'll be even slower. Beats. We'll come back to that in a moment. Waves can move on strings. And the thing about the waves is if I have a wave that's moving on a string, and it encounters a boundary, such as your string is tied right here, it will reflect. When the wave reflects, the wave that's coming this way interferes with the wave that's going that way, and they'll combine. In this case, the mathematical analysis involves interfering a wave of a given frequency going this way with a wave of the same frequency traveling that way. And it turns out that when these two waves interfere, you get a very interesting phenomenon that happens at particular frequencies. Okay. So I have sort of this wave. And if I just do any sort of frequency, you sort of see a strange random pattern. But let me now look at what happens when the wave that's traveling this way reflects and interferes in a constructive way with the wave that's coming back. When you get it right, they sort of add together. And you get what's called a resonance, which means you sort of get a big vibration. If this were a musical instrument, this vibration we would call the fundamental frequency of the string. If I go up in frequency, you get this random stuff that happens, and then when you hit the right frequency, you get a resonance with that vibration. Hard to keep it. If I go up in frequency a little bit more, this would be the first harmonic. And note it's a higher frequency. In fact, it is twice the frequency of the harmonic. So if you're listening to a musical instrument and they play the fundamental, you hear a tone. If they play the first harmonic, you'll hear a tone that has twice the frequency. It'll be up. If I go up a little higher in frequency, I can get the second harmonic. I'm sorry, the first one is fundamental. It's the first harmonic. This would be the second. What we just saw, the second harmonic. This is the third harmonic. So you get a stable oscillating pattern where it interferes with itself. I go up a little bit more. I can get
fourth one.
Up a little bit more. I get the fifth harmonic. A little bit more. Alright, well, you get the idea. Alright? But notice for lots of frequencies, I don't get this so-called resonance. It doesn't build on itself, okay? So that's why, if you have a stringed instrument, and you have a fixed length with a fixed tension and a fixed mass per unit string, it will play a certain note. And you can make it play a note at twice the frequency if you want to just touch it right here, because that allows the vibration of that first harmonic. Or if you want the third harmonic, you could touch it right here, because then it allows the third harmonic to happen, but not the first two. Right? So you can play all sorts of games with it. If I want to change the frequency of this thing, I can tighten it up a little bit. Or I can use a string that has more mass. And we've already seen how the velocity changes. So for a given period of oscillation, you'll get a different frequency if you have different masses. When you set up a system where only waves of particular frequencies will resonate and will work, you say you quantize the system. Everything is not possible to do. Only certain frequencies work. And that would be a quantized system. So in reality, you can say that music is nothing more than quantized vibrations on strings, and that's really what it's all about. I say on strings. You can do the same thing for vibrations of air molecules in tubes. Okay, so horns. I'm not going to drag you through that, but it's really the same analysis. It just takes a little more work to visualize it. I'm going to let you play with this a little bit, probably in next week's rotation. Not play with this, but actually do a little bit of a calculation for the frequencies that you would see on a certain string, just to get a bit of a better feel for it. But these are generically known as standing waves on strings. And they're a direct result of the fact that waves exhibit interference. And that's what we're seeing here. Okay? Any questions? Comments? Yes?
There are two types of waves. One goes this way, one goes this way. And for mother, it's like this. So you said there's also something called energy pressure energy.
Well,
does it, like, does water move a little bit this way, even if it's doing this, like the particles? How does it have pressure energy if only it's moving up and down?
The wave shape goes ahead, and it turns out that you do have energy flowing along the way. It's very strange that that happens, but it does. The same is true for longitudinal waves. If you calculate the energy flow through a plane here, you'll actually get a non-zero thing. So I'm not really sure I understood the question. You want to try again?
It's like you said, at some point the particles are more than the other point because there's a
right. So for air pressure, for sound waves, you can imagine having a tuning fork like we just had. And the tuning fork, this thing is vibrating back and forth. And so as it moves forward, for example, it might create, sort of pushes air molecules into others and creates a region of high pressure, which then these molecules, all being close together, will start to move apart. And so they'll push molecules beside them. So and as they move apart, they'll actually create a bit of a vacuum. So you end up with a wave that propagates in air that sort of looks like this in terms of pressure, and the molecules are just going back and forth. And the analysis, although sometimes harder to visualize, is exactly like the stuff that we just did. So, you heard the standing waves here with the sound. Well, those are beats, actually, not standing waves. But
this is longitudinal wave, right? This is longitudinal.
This is transverse. This and that's longitudinal. Yeah.
What about transverse?
Well, that's just like what we saw here, because the wave itself is moving perpendicular. I think it's not super relevant for us. But okay. this would be a transverse wave because it's the wave itself, the motion of the particles is perpendicular to the direction of the wave. Yeah.
So when you had two waves going in opposite directions, they kind of go through each other.
Yeah.
Why don't they cause each other to like bounce back in the opposite direction?
Because they're waves.
So is that like inconsistent?
That's one of the things that characterize the wave. For example, if I shoot two billiard balls at each other, they bounce off each other and they bounce back. And that's sort of what you mean by particle. Waves don't do that.
Just don't.
Yeah.
Does transverse wave have energy questions?
Does a transverse wave have energy? Transverse waves carry energy. Longitudinal waves carry energy. Waves carry energy.
So does it have like one, does transverse wave have one part of the particles are like more than one part of the particles is less?
At any given moment, yeah, if I froze time and I tried to get a measure of what was the energy density along the wave, it would vary. And a way to think about that is as a particle is moving, so consider a particle here, it moves in simple harmonic motion, all right? So what that means is it's moving fast, it slows down, it comes to a stop. Then it goes back, it moves fast, it slows down, it comes to a stop. So you can think of its kinetic energy, which is a measure of its energy of motion, is going to be greatest here in the middle and less when it's down here. So if I froze the wave, you might imagine regions where you could imagine having more energy than other regions. But on average, as the wave flows, that doesn't matter. What manifests itself in the real world is how does this wave impact whatever it's hitting, and that's a measure of intensity, which is a measure of basically how much energy hits per unit area, per unit time. So that would be like the brightness of light or the intensity of the sound or something like that. Yeah.
Can you touch on the amplitude of longitudinal? Is it just how many particles are compressed?
It would be more if you tagged a single particle, it would be sort of how much is it moving back and forth. So if you're right by the speaker in the concert, the molecules are vibrating quite a bit. Okay. And as you move away, it turns out that amplitude of vibration will drop off as a square of the distance you go. So the intensity drops off as the square. So move a little bit further away from the speaker if your ears are moving. Yeah.
I don't know if this is going to be another lecture, but there's also ways that don't require media.
Stay tuned, yeah. That turns out to be very important, and we'll be getting there. Probably not by the end of this lecture, but next, yeah.
What about short waves and old videos and FM?
Okay, so let's come back to that. Yeah, so, you guys are getting ahead of me. Okay, so waves exhibit interference, and I hope you agree with me that that's actually sort of cool. Waves also exhibit what is known as diffraction. And what diffraction means, is that the waves will spread out if they go through a small opening. I'm going to show you demos next time that show this, but imagine that you are in an airplane and you're sort of going over a port area where they have a breakwater in the surf to sort of keep the waves from bothering the boats in the harbor. Then you might imagine a situation where you have waves sort of traveling in toward the shore like this, and then they hit a region where there's basically a bunch of rocks and stuff that, like so, but there's an opening where the boats can go through, And if you look at the waves as they pass through that opening, what you'll find is that they come out doing that. Okay? And that's the example that's coming to mind right now. You may have other examples, but I'll certainly show this in an actual water thing next class. So I'll prove this to you. But it turns out to be an important characteristic of waves. And then a third characteristic that waves exhibit, it's very important, is that they undergo what is called refraction. And refraction basically says that waves can bend at the interface between media or substances. So what we have seen is that the speed of the wave depends on the medium. Okay? Light medium or easy to move mass, it moves fast, hits the heavy one, it moves slow. Okay? So imagine what would happen if we had a marching band walking along on a good hard-packed road or sidewalk, okay? And they're marching in line like this. Like so, okay? And suddenly they hit a region like this, which is muddy. I mean, pretty thick mud. So as the marching band members hit the mud, they cannot move as fast. So it's a new medium, okay? So what will happen with the marching band as they begin to hit it is that all of a sudden here they start to move slower. And that means they do not go as far as the guys here do. So what you'll find is that basically the whole thing turns. Not my best drawing. Let me show you. I have it here. Yeah. Can you see that? You see the different red lines? That would represent sort of the crests of the wave. And as the wave goes, here you have a region where the wave is moving more slowly. And so what you see is that because as the wave enters here, the particles are moving more slowly, effectively you get this whole thing ends up making a turn. And the degree of that turn depends on the speed with which the wave moves in the two media. So if I change, if I make the medium a little bit faster, it changes the angle. If I make it slower, it's more of an angle. That phenomenon is known as refraction. Yes?
I'm kind of trying to clarify in my mind. I'm not sure how, I don't see how the slit scenario there is a change in your medium. Isn't it just that there's a block in the path of the propagation of the wave?
No, it's the speed with which it goes in the medium. Let me try again on this.
I'm not sure.
Let me actually try this better. I didn't do a very good job on it. I think it helps if I make it bigger. All right, so this is moving with a certain speed, and it has a certain frequency. All right? Now, the frequency is how often per second sort of the crest hits. So the frequency actually turns out to stay the same, but the so let's say that we have a change in medium. So here are the marching band in nice lines, and all of a sudden they hit this muddy medium. Okay, so all of this is muddy. So now what will happen is these people haven't hit the mud yet, so they keep going at the same speed. These people have hit the mud just only recently, so they slowed down, but they just slowed down. These people are hitting the mud right now. How do I say this? Yeah, these people are just hitting the mud. The people that should be over here on that wave, okay, on that wave front, have now been walking in the mud for a while, so they've been going slower. So they aren't going to have gone nearly as far. So that means you'll end up with something that looks like that. So the distance, the wavelength has actually changed. The frequency turns out to be the same. Even though this distance is shorter, they're now moving more slowly. So the number of rows that pass by you per second stays the same. Frequency is what characterizes the wave itself. The wavelength actually depends on what medium it's in. So what will happen in the end is by the time, if you look at it, what happens is the marching band ends up marching at a different angle because of this effect. This is known as refraction. So it turns out that a wave is a wave, and all waves exhibit these three characteristics. Okay? Let's see what other notes I have. I think that was it for those. Okay. Fields, which we started talking about at the start of class last time. And just to remind you, we imagine that the electric force in the space surrounding a charged particle is conveyed by the electric field that this charged particle creates in the space around. And we picture it as little arrows in space. So if I put a positive particle here, I know, or I can imagine what would happen to a positive particle if I put it in the space at different locations around that charged particle. And we can visualize what would happen to that other particle by the magnitude and direction of the force that it would feel if it were at one of those points. And so when doing so, you end up drawing a picture sort of like this. All of these arrows are supposed to be going out radially. The length of them will drop off as the square of the distance from the center. And if you can imagine mentally every point in space from that particle out to infinity has an assignment, which is one of these arrows, then you have imagined basically what we call a field. And you can describe it mathematically, okay? We're no longer just putting numbers at every point, so it has number in a direction, and mathematically we call that the vectors. So you can describe this with a vector field, per se. And in today's recitation, one of the things you're going to do is to put a bar magnet on the floor or something. And if I have a bar magnet, remember if you play with little magnets, north poles attract south poles and they repel north poles. So if I were to have a little bar magnet, I can play the same kind of game. I can try to map out what I would call the magnetic field by putting little bar magnets all around this bar magnet and ask what is the force on it. So if I were to put a little bar magnet right here, it would be oriented so that its south pole is facing this north pole. So you would end up with a little south-north like that. If I put one over here, I would end up with a north-south sort of like that. If I put one right here, I would end up with a south-north sort of like that. Is that making sense to you? If I put it over here, I'll end up with a north-south sort of like that. So it turns out you can now visualize the magnetic field as little arrows that sort of show you how a little bar magnet would orient itself. And for magnets, you can visualize the field for this bar magnet, the pink one here that I initially put. The magnetic field sort of does this. So it's, again, stronger close to the magnet. It falls off, actually, in strength as one over the square. And it has the weirdness that it sort of loops back around on itself. And that's not happening here. Here, the field just goes out, and it just drops off in strength, but it continues to go out forever. Here, the field sort of loops back in. So here, we can have something called a point charge. It turns out there are no point charges in magnetism. We may talk a little bit about, in fact, we will talk a little bit about that later on. Let's not worry too much about it. So one of the things you'll do in class, in recitation today, is to actually physically have something in the lab where you're actually looking, not in the lab, but in the room, where you can look at sort of the shape of this field. So we have basically examples in our life where we learn about electricity, electric charge. So I can take a balloon, rub it on my hair, and put it on the wall. I can take the cover off in the middle of night when the room is dark. And when you do, you're rubbing dissimilar materials together often. That will cause some of the electric charge to transfer. There's a big force between them, so sometimes that will cause a small breakdown in the air, and some of those charges will transfer, and you'll see little sparks. So on a big scale, that's lightning. So that's electricity. Then you play with bar magnets. That's magnetism. Now, it turns out that those really seem like very different phenomena. And they do manifest themselves in real life, sort of this very different phenomenon. In class next time, I will do some demos to show you that they have a very deep relationship. And I want to give you just a little bit of a flavor for that. If you were to take a compass needle or a little bar magnet, and you just put it on the table, it would orient itself in Earth's magnetic field. So it turns out the Earth has a natural magnetic field. It's like a bit of a natural bar magnet. And that's what a compass is noticing, okay? If I were to take that compass needle and put it here, and then I were to run a big electric current through this wire, if this were a wire, okay? You would see this compass needle move around. So what that says is that if I take electric charges and I move them, they will create a magnetic field. I create a magnetic field by putting an electric field along this wire. If I put an electric field along this wire, then charges that are here feel a force, and that's what causes them to move. So when I do that, with moving charges in a changing electric field, will create a magnetic field. So suddenly, when you start to look at it in detail, and you start doing more experiments on it, you begin to realize that electricity and magnetism are not separate things. There's some sort of deep relationship there. Another example would be if I have sort of a big magnet, and I'll show you a device like this next class, where I create a magnetic field right here. We use the symbol B for magnetic field and E for electric field, just so you know, because I'll do it without even thinking, so I want to I'll at least tell you once what it is I'm trying to say. If I have this and I have a wire that passes through that region, if that wire is not carrying a current, it's just sitting there, so the electric charges are static, there is no force on that wire. If I now put a current through that wire, if there's no magnetic field there, the wire just sits there nicely and it has current going through it. By current, I mean moving charge. If I have a magnetic field on each passing in this region, and I put a current through this wire, there's a force on this wire. Okay, so again, oddly enough, there's a very deep relationship between what's happening with the electric field and what's happening with magnetic fields. So I'm going to do some demos for that next class, but what I'm driving at is the following. The relationship between the electric fields and the magnetic fields that I'm getting to was really put on a mathematical basis by James Clerk Maxwell in 1873. So there's James. And in fact, these are the equations which, if they speak to you, they speak to you. They usually don't speak to anybody unless they've had calculus-based physics. And I'm not trying to be annoying by putting them up there, but I sort of want you to see them for a few reasons. There's some things I sort of want to point out. I mean,
just looking at the symbols, you can see there's some degree of symmetry in them. I would put this up as possibly the single most important creative act by humankind, right there. And here's why. What these equations tell you is that if I were, for example, to take electric charge in my hand and I were to start moving it like this, okay? What these equations tell you is that I have an electric field in the space here because I have charge in my hand, okay? As I move it, that electric field in space is changing. When I have it here, I have a strong electric field pointing out like so. When I move this down, the electric field here is weaker and it's stronger here. All right, so I am literally changing the electric field in the space here as I move this charge up and down. What these equations tell you is that when you have a changing electric field, it induces in the space around it a changing magnetic field at right angles to it. Trust me. So as I move this down, I'm creating this changing electric field, which induces a changing magnetic field in the space around it. These equations also say, if I have a changing magnetic field, it induces a changing electric field in the space around it. So now you get a weird sort of self-coupled system. I have a changing electric field. It induces a changing magnetic field in the space around it, which induces a changing electric field in the space around it, which induces a changing magnetic field in the space around it, which induces a changing electric field in the space around it. And when you take these equations and you calculate the speed with which this phenomenon propagates outward, you find it happens at the speed of light. And that, my friends, is the essence of light. And I probably should just not say anything else for this class. We will come back to that and we will explore the implications of that. But these equations hold the secret of light. And in doing so, they show us that there is this deep, intimate relationship between electricity and magnetism, such that we have unified these two separate forces into one theory, which we call electromagnetism. And from this, we can understand all phenomena that involve light. And by light, I mean visible light that you see, microwaves, ultraviolet light, X-rays, gamma rays, radio waves, all types. Okay? So it's an extremely rich thing, and our entire society is really based on our understanding of this stuff in a lot of ways. So it's very cool stuff. Anyway, we'll come back to it.
Presentation is in the book I use. They sometimes put it that way, but they wanted to write it the simplest.
Well, there's the differential form.
Yeah.
That's a C. Yeah, that's a C for it's a. A loop integral. So it's a loop integral around the curve. And so what this is telling you is that the
surface.
That so you have two surface integrals, you have two loop integrals.
Yeah, the loop integral.
And so the top one is the amount of electric flux or the electric field that penetrates the surface of some surface.
Okay? Right.
Equal to the charge inside. The second one says, for magnetism, whenever the field penetrates through, it also comes back. The third one says,
right.
It says that
the amount of electric field, magnetic field penetrating through a surface that's changing with time generates at right angles to it an electric field in the space around it. And then this one says if I have an electric field penetrating through space changing with time, it generates in the space at right angles to it a magnetic field, basically.
Yeah, that's the one where your head explodes.
This is where you get the self-coupling.
Yeah.
Because changing B gives you E, changing E gives you E.
What is this?
That term, this is actually what Maxwell did, is he noticed, it's called the displacement current. So the real intuition that I'm talking about is what you get in a area where you have no current. There's a weird example that sort of gave Maxwell the clue in how this works and pulling it all together.
Okay, when you drop this cat off the ceiling?
Well, so
I was reading the book.
Yeah. This, conceptually, I would just ignore it. Calculationally, there's a particular example. For example, if you have a parallel plate capacitor in a circuit and you're trying to understand it in the picture of these, then you have to have that term.
That detailed, and then after that you use symmetry to make it, simplify it, right? That's this one where
well, there's a lot of symmetry in it, yeah.
Symmetry things.
The thing that breaks the symmetry in these equations is that there's no magnetic monopole.
And what would happen if they found one? I mean, would that really screw things up?
Oh, I mean, it would be
like tripping, like physics would just
you can put them in here and it sort of works. Mm. It's not a problem, but nobody's ever seen one.
Right.
And so one of the problems is that it's so natural and compelling theoretically
that
I mean, we'll come back to it, but one of the reasons that people believe in inflation, which is this weird expansion of space we're going to talk about in cosmology, this super expansion of space.
Right.
One of the